There are special Spinoza bagels, and we don't generally serve bagels in the evening, but when Gordon and I were talking about this evening, after years, I had wanted and hoped that Rabbi Gordon Tucker would be teaching us about Spinoza. It's been a not-so-secret hope of mine for many years. Anyway, as the evening came closer, Gordon sent me a picture of the bagel Spinoza from Trader Joe's. So couldn't pass up the opportunity. There are bagel Spinoza in the back. And we actually unscrewed and moved over a toaster oven. So you can toast a bagel. It's ridiculous. It's toasted bagels.
Right.
It's butter and cheese. The bagels are not already sliced. Be careful. You slice them open. And since not everyone appreciates bagels in the evening, there's also brownies and cookies. Also from Trader Joe's. While I was there. Yeah, they're really fabulous.
You have to tell us, what is a Spinoza bagel?
Well, Gordon is going to explain that. Gordon is not only a rabbi, he's, for me, he's also a friend. And we are part of a group of rabbis who began, many of us know each other for decades before we ended up in White Plains. And these years been colleagues and friends and spiritual mentors, colleagues, and support from one another is a great, immeasurably great gift. Gordon is not only all of that, he's also an intellect. Not every rabbi is an intellect and a thinker. And this year, many of us are studying about different aspects of the Jews of Spain and the Sephardic Jewish experience, Portugal and Spain, and this is spilling over into the post-1492 part of the story, into the 1600s in Amsterdam, and something that will change, bring in the modern period. I think many of us know that we'll learn about Spinoza this week and in 2 weeks. February 6th is the second of 2 sessions. We'll be in the chapel again and spread the word. It's here. And our class only meets on the other side, but we need more space tonight. And I want to say more, but I won't waste any of our time. Gordon, thank you for being here tonight.
Thank you. I have to disappoint you that I have nothing to say about the bagels.
Is the microphone on?
Sent it to me.
Did you put the microphone on?
I did, of course.
Yeah,
so.
Please do. Thank you.
Opus.
The light turns red. Thank you.
Okay. Good. Yeah, it's okay. Good. I don't have to shout. That's good. Someone sent it to me. I don't even know who it was, and I immediately forwarded it on to Shira, so I thought it was hilarious. But anyway, you'll tell me how it tastes, those of you who've had it. So I was actually, I didn't know this was a secret wish for these years, but it's never in any way a chore for me to talk about this. It's a maybe a little bit of an odd thing to for a rabbi to talk about, sort of being a little bit in love with this particular thinker, given his not so sterling reputation for all of these centuries, but it's true. And I had the great privilege of being able to study his work with one of the great interpreters of Spinoza, and that was Margaret Wilson. So that was a great period in my education in philosophy. So look, we're going to begin, as you always have to, with the dramatic scene in July 1656 which happened actually 3 days before Tisha B'Av. And it was on the 6th of Av in that year, that the following announcement was made in the Portuguese synagogue in Amsterdam. By the way, some of you may have been at the Portuguese synagogue in Amsterdam, not the same one. That was built a couple of years later, but it is the successor to it. So here's what happened on that July day. The gentleman of the Ma'amad, so that's the kind of like the board of trustees, make known to you that having for some time known the evil opinions and works of Baruch de Espinoza, they have endeavored by various ways and promises to draw him back from his evil ways. And not being able to remedy him, but on the contrary, receiving every day more news about the horrible heresies he practices and teaches to others, and the awful deeds he performed, and having of this many reliable testimonies, all given in the presence of the said Espinoza, which convinced them. And all this having been examined in the presence of the gentlemen Chachamim, the rabbinic authorities, they resolved with the latter's consent that the said Espinoza be put to the harem and banished from the nation of Israel, as indeed they proclaim in the following harem on him. And now comes a kind of a formal statement. By the decree of the angels and the word of the holy men, we ban, cut off, curse, and anathematize Baruch de Espinoza with the consent of God, blessed be he, and with the consent of all the holy congregation, in front of these holy scrolls, with the 613 precepts that are written therein, with the excommunication with which Joshua banned Jericho, with the curse with which Elisha cursed the boys, and with all the curses that are written in the book of the law. Cursed be he by day, and cursed be he by night. Cursed be he when he lies down, and cursed be he when he rises up. Cursed be he when he goes out, and cursed be he when he comes in. The Lord will not spare him. The anger and wrath of the Lord will rage against this man, and bring upon him all the curses that are written in this book. And the Lord will blot out his name from under heaven, and the Lord will separate him to his injury from all the tribes of Israel, with all the curses of the covenant that are written in the book of the law. But you, who cleave unto the Lord God, are all alive this day. We order that no one should communicate with him orally or in writing, or show him any favor, or stay with him under the same roof, or come within 4 cubits of him, or read anything composed or written by him. That's a mouthful. Right? Have a nice day. Right? Yes. So this is actually not as extraordinary as it may seem. Obviously, there's a good deal of rhetorical overkill here, and some of it is boilerplate, a lot of it is boilerplate language from the Torah. From Deuteronomy 28, and you know, it's the way you curse people. And they did this a lot to people who they wanted to discipline. Sometimes it was of short duration, sometimes a little longer duration. It would put the fear of God in you. That's not to say that these sorts of things never had any dramatic effect. One famous example, and it was famous at that time, was the president in the experience of one Uriel da Costa, whose life ended in suicide after multiple bans and after the humiliation of having to endure corporal punishment as a condition of reinstatement into the community. And also the converso experience. So these were, you know, Portuguese Jews expelled from the Iberian Peninsula in 1497 in Portugal. But those who stayed were these conversos, Moranos, who were constantly in fear of the Inquisition as back new Christians, backsliding Christians. So that converso experience, which was so common among the Amsterdam Jews, was no doubt some factor in the sensitivity about heresy. Although you can't you've got to appreciate the irony that the harshness of the rhetoric is made somewhat ironic by that experience that they and their parents or grandparents, great-grandparents had had. In Spinoza's case, however, there was very little drama in the end because he simply walked away and formed new circles of support. If you want to see Spinoza's house today, you don't go to Amsterdam, you go to The Hague. And that in itself is walking away and saying, see ya, may have played its own role in the long-running anathematizing of Baruch in the Jewish community, meaning for the next 360-some-odd years. He was the person who was not interested in reinstating, not interested in making nice, and just said, farewell. And as we will see a little bit later, some scholars make a very interesting and strong case that the converso experience explains not only the excommunicators, but explains something about the excommunicants as well, and notably Spinoza himself. But we will get to that in a little bit. But before we get that far, so here's some important cultural and intellectual background, which is quite apart from anything having to do with Jewish experiences in the Iberian Peninsula. Just general cultural and intellectual background as the 16th century yielded to the 17th. So this is, what I'm going to read you now is a somewhat brief passage from one of the last books written by Stephen Jay Gould. So here's what he writes. We continue to revere the Renaissance, literally meaning the rebirth, because we so admire the works of Leonardo and Michelangelo, and because we so respectfully refer to rare folks of multiple talents as Renaissance men and women. And thus the very mention of the Renaissance tends to evoke an image of forward-looking modernity in our minds. But our modern concept of science could never have flourished or even been conceived at all under the aims and sensibilities of the Renaissance. Don't confuse the Renaissance with the scientific revolution. This movement did wish to augment the storehouse of human knowledge, but not by discovering new truths of nature through observation and experiment. As the name implies, Renaissance scholars sought a rebirth, not an accumulation or a revolution. They believed that everything worth knowing has been ascertained by the great intellects of the classical world. But then they were either not transcribed or more likely lost to the West during a thousand intervening dark years, as libraries burned and decayed, and new dogmas clouded the ancient spirit of liberal learning. Thus, for the Renaissance, the recovery of ancient wisdom, not the discovery of novel data, became the primary task of scholarship. And that's in many ways the story of the 16th century. And now, we are in the age of science, in Spinoza's time. And in other words, what Gould is telling us is that for denizens of the age of science and its revolution, there was to be no bowing to the authority of tradition. Not what science is about. So-and-so said something at one time about how great they were. Let's see if we can reproduce it in the laboratory. And this was in the air for everyone, and Spinoza was such a person. He was a free thinker. Everyone knows that. What they may not know as readily is that he was also a person with a very lofty vision of a grand unity, not unlike what is found among many mystics. And to make things even more complicated, he was a believer in necessity. So consider this poignant passage from the end of part four of his most important philosophical work, which we will get to, called The Ethics. Here's how he ends. There are five parts to the Ethics. And the end of part four contains this passage on the subject of believing in necessity. We shall patiently bear whatever happens to us that is contrary to what is required by consideration of our own advantage. If we are conscious that we are a part of the whole of nature whose order we follow. For insofar as we understand, we can desire nothing but that which must be. Just wait for a moment. Nor in an absolute sense can we find contentment in anything but truth. Did you all catch that? It's a kind of a long sentence. We shall patiently bear whatever happens to us that we wish didn't happen. We'll bear it if we're conscious that we're part of a whole of nature whose order we follow. And if we understand, well, we'll understand that we can't desire anything but that which has to be, which must be, which of necessity is going to be. And in an absolute sense, we can't find contentment in anything but that truth. We think of someone as a free thinker, but you're not hearing a lot of freedom here. Right? So, as another contemporary Spinoza scholar, Stephen Smith, poses questions in the following way about this mysterious figure. Was he a soulless materialist and atheist? Or was he a mystical pantheist? Pantheism. God is everywhere and everything. Was he a ruthless determinist who believed that nothing escaped the causal order of nature? Or an apostle of human freedom whose philosophy sought to liberate the mind from bondage to false beliefs? What was he? A believer in determinism, but someone who was politically active in Republican politics in the Netherlands? Which is it? Well, I taught Spinoza's philosophy for some years at Jewish Theological Seminary, and obviously I would not have done so were I not to have what I started out at the very beginning saying, a fair amount of regard, even more than regard, for Spinoza's thought, and the ways in which I think it continues to challenge us and inspire us today. There is one idea, which we're not going to get to much tonight at all, but we will in 2 weeks. There is one idea, but I'm going to mention it now for a particular reason. There's one idea with which he is forever associated, and which made his break with the Jewish community inevitable. And that was the idea which was fully expressed in his probably better known work, but a work of lesser importance philosophically, and that is what's called the Theological Political Treatise. The idea that Judaism was a system of law, but not a religion. That is what he meant. This is not a conveyor of timeless religious truths. Judaism is a set of laws for a political people. Jew, Yehudi, Judean, they lived in Judea. They had a Judean kingdom. They needed laws. Every kingdom needs laws. For Spinoza, of course, that meant that with the end of all Jewish sovereignty and the end of all Jewish self-government 17 centuries before he was born, Jewish law had lost the context that gave it any meaning at all. And that the rabbis had been completely irrational, not only in retaining it, but in developing it, refining it as they had into the centerpiece of Jewish religion, what they called Jewish religion. And his formulation of this idea was stark and shocking. Because what he said was that engaging with Jewish law, on the one hand, and engaging with religious thought, or in short, with religion on the other, were two totally different things. One was, if there ever were to be Jewish sovereignty again, it would make sense as a political thing, but it couldn't possibly be conveying what religion is supposed to convey, which is sort of timeless universal truths that should have nothing to do with a particular political context. interesting thing to mull over in terms of the somewhat muddled sense of what exactly what Jewish identity is. He was one of the people who sharpened this for us in the 17th century. In other words, he was leveling strong challenges at Judaism, which we will talk about in 2 weeks. But more broadly, I read this to you, now I didn't read it to you, I summarized it to you, because he was after the essence of a universal religion or a universal faith or a universal inspiration for how to live. So the plan is that tonight we're going to talk mostly about the Ethics. The Ethics was published after his death. The Theological Political Treatise was published in his lifetime under a pseudonym. But it didn't take long for whatever the precursors of CNN and MSNBC were to have leaked to them who this actually was, and no doubt played some role in his difficulties with the Jewish community, and for that matter, and to some extent with the church as well. The Ethics is our subject tonight. That is, tonight is about Spinoza and religion in its most general setting. In 2 weeks, we'll build on this by turning to the Theological Political Treatise and discuss what one person has called Spinoza's onslaught on Judaism and the reactions to that and how his thought has survived and resurfaced in various surprising ways. Just a little spoiler alert here. It resurfaces and survives even to some extent in early Hasidic and in Neo-Hasidic thought. So why is it called the Ethics? You pick up a book on ethics, you expect to see case studies in what happens in businesses, in multinational corporations. You might see something about medical ethics and what sorts of decisions you make at end of life. That's what you expect to see in a book on ethics. Why is this book called The Ethics when it has none of that? Well, the answer to that is it is about the good, which is what ethics is supposed to be about, but it is about the good in the same way as Maimonides viewed ethics a few centuries before Spinoza. That is, it's not about retail ethics. What do I do in this particular situation or others like it? It's rather kind of the wholesale variety. Spinoza, by the way, read Maimonides. He quotes Maimonides. It was part of his curriculum growing up, as the Bible and the Talmud was. And Spinoza usually pretended to reject him thoroughly, but his debt to him is palpable. In certain ways, Spinoza can be seen, maybe we'll have occasion to talk about this in 2 weeks, can almost be seen as taking Maimonides to his dangerous conclusions that Maimonides himself was not willing to do. But Maimonides, to get back to the present point, following Aristotle, which Maimonides always did, nearly always did, he believed that ethics was properly approached not as a subject about choices of action, but rather as a subject concerned with the building of character. It wasn't about training people to do the right thing in specific circumstances. It was about building character so that you didn't have to make those choices in particular circumstances because the internal ethical navigation system was doing it for you. And in like fashion, the ethics, Spinoza's ethics, capital E, offers no answer to the question, what ought I to do? And that's why the question of why it has that title, The Ethics, often arises. But it did very much set out to answer the prior and more fundamental question, how ought I to live? So now let's begin to get into what the ethics teaches us. So as I mentioned, it's in five parts. This same Stephen Smith, whom I mentioned earlier, a little fancifully perhaps, suggests that maybe it's not entirely coincidental that the Ethics has five parts and the Torah has five parts, five books. But not so fanciful at all. is his insight that in many ways the ethics is what he calls an extended midrash on the opening passage of the Shema. What does it mean that God is one? Adonai Echad. What does that mean? You've probably seen at least five different translations of that into English. If God is truly the source of all power and perfection, then how can God create something outside of God, independent of God, limiting of God? Because anything outside you limits you. How is that possible? Here's an interesting conundrum that I'll just throw off for you, which comes out in Maimonides and in Spinoza. Maimonides kind of punts on the question. How could, if God is all-powerful, and God is invulnerable, God is of necessity self-sufficient, the necessary being, which Maimonides begins his whole code of Jewish law by saying that, what does it mean to say God created the world? We create things when we need them. What did God need? What does it even mean to say that God needs something if God is the all-powerful, all-knowing, the source of all power and the source of all wisdom? So there is already a built-in tension between God the Creator and God the all-powerful God. And as I said, we're not discussing Maimonides here per se. Maimonides kind of punted on that one. But Spinoza did not. And he was dealing with this. Right? What does it mean to, when you say, the Lord is our God, the Lord is one. And if God is one, does that not make everything else part of God? Isn't there some kind of a version of pantheism already wrapped up in that that sentence that we piously say every morning and evening? So, if we wanted to specify a little better what it is that is so high voltage about what Spinoza did in the Ethics, one of the useful ways to set that forth is in a neat summation that was given by another great Spinoza interpreter, and that was the philosopher Harry Austin Wolfson. And he enumerates what he calls four acts of daring that Spinoza put out there into the philosophical world and into the theological world. And here are the four. It's a little unfortunate that the way Wolfson chose to phrase it, it comes out in kind of double negatives, so I'll try to make sure that you get the point, because double negatives are always a little hard to follow. He said, by declaring that God has the attribute of extension as well as of thought, very anti-Maimonidean. Maimonides insisted God does not have a body. God is pure thought, is the act of intellect. Spinoza said, God, and we will see this whole idea about God being the only substance, we're not there yet. Extension means it's essentially a physical thing. I extend from here to here. God has extension. God has attributes that space has, as well as thought. By saying that, says Wolfson, Spinoza, here comes kind of the double negative. He has removed the break in the principle of the homogeneity of nature, meaning he insisted that nature was homogeneous, that there wasn't the kind of this physical world and then there's this godly world. It is all one. And that was his first act of daring. The second was by denying design and purpose in God. Does God have a purpose in doing things? Does God decide? We're back to this problem of creation and omnipotence, right? I would like the following consequence to follow, and I'm gonna, in order to get there, I'm going to have to do this, to use what we're reading now in these weeks in the Torah. I need Pharaoh to let the people go. I'm going to have to bring certain plagues there to convince him to let them go. Right? And not only that, I don't want it to go so fast, so I'm going to make it a little harder for him to react to this, but in the end, it's going to go, and it's all this design and purpose in God. Spinoza denies this. But that even makes sense. And here comes the double negative again. By doing this, Spinoza has removed the break in the principle of the uniformity of the laws of nature. The laws of nature do not get interrupted. There's no God who says, I need to split a sea right now. There is no such thing. So that's the second act of daring. The third act of daring is his insistence on the complete inseparability of soul from body. It's not only that God has this unity of God is both space and thought, but human beings are as well. It's not like I have a body and when I die, my soul escapes to wherever it is. No matter how piously we may say that at Jewish funerals. Just officiated at one today, and you know, you look at the rabbi's manuals, and there's the book of Kohelet that tells you the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. That's dualism. Spinoza denied it. Spinoza said there's a complete inseparability of soul from body. These are just two attributes, two aspects of the same thing that we and everything else is, including God. So that removes another break in the homogeneity of things. And finally, you can probably see this one coming now, because if God is kind of homogeneous this way, and everything else, including we, are homogeneous in this way, and if God doesn't have any purpose or any kind of freedom of the will, then the fourth thing is clearly going to be his insistence upon the elimination of freedom of the will from human actions. This is why the question arises, is he a ruthless determinist? And if so, why is he involved in political activism? Does he think you can change things? Does he think you can make choices? Does he not? And that was his fourth act of daring. How fundamental the idea of free will is to holding people responsible for things, for the whole idea of divine reward and punishment, all of these things are really out the window. So Spinoza, in that way, departed from the traditional theologies of Judaism and Christianity and Islam. Okay, so it's time to look a little bit at how he articulates these ideas and principles. So I'm going to read you a couple of, I'm not going to read you his demonstrations and his corollaries and all of that stuff. One of the things I think the ethics, everyone will aver that it is one of the hardest books to read that's ever been written, and to some extent that's true. But sometimes when a book is very hard to read, you have to reorient yourself and say, I may not be reading it with the right expectations and the right kind of rhythm. One of the things you have to do, if you ever have the boldness and adventurousness of spirit to pick up the ethics and say, I think I'm going to try to read this, my recommendation to you is try and read it as if it's poetry. Don't get hung up in all of the proofs and the demonstrations. Go from proposition to proposition and try to get a sense of what he's weaving together here. Worry another time whether he convinces you with his demonstrations or not. But get a sense of what his vision is here and what he's trying to say. So that's what I'm going to do. I'm going to skip from one proposition to another, not reading you all of them. But in the first part of the Ethics, when he gets to proposition 11, he says, God, or, now he's going to tell you what God is, substance consisting of infinite attributes. It's a, but actually he means the, and the one and only substance in the world. That has infinite number of attributes, but all of the same thing. Each of which expresses eternal and infinite essence, that God necessarily exists. Oh, I thought he was an atheist. God necessarily exists. That's interesting. But wait a minute, is it the God that I think of, or is it some other kind of God? Is this atheism in disguise? Is this atheism that's sort of cleaned up for the censors, so to speak? Or does he really mean it? What is he really after here? So, this God, this substance that's all-encompassing and has all the attributes of infinity to it, necessarily exists. And then in Proposition 14, he says, there can be or be conceived no other substance but God. Here's a little spoiler alert. We'll get back to this in 2 weeks, and we probably won't have complete congruence of audience from the 2 weeks. I mentioned something about how sometimes, in certain ways, this pops up in some early Hasidic thought. Arthur Green found and called our attention to, actually, it's not such early Hasidic thought, it's actually rather late Hasidic thought now that I think of it, a letter that the person we call the Sfas-Emes, he was one of the greatest of the Gera Hasidim, and he died just a few years into the 20th century, this essentially a late 19th century figure, that he wrote a letter for a kind of a, almost like an ethical will to his grandchildren, in which he said, I want you to know what the true secret meaning of Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad is in the Shema. The real secret esoteric meaning of that is not that God is one and can't be separated, not that God is our God alone and no other gods. It means God is all there is. Sounds a whole lot like Proposition 14, the ethics, right? There can be or be conceived no other substance but God. So when I said a few minutes ago that one of the things you discover about him when you begin to read him, you can't help being taken in a little bit by some kind of vision here of this unity and this all-encompassing harmony that is there, to be sure, in strange and unfamiliar ways, and certainly doesn't comport with anything we learned in Sunday school, day school, or wherever we were educated at home or elsewhere in Jewish values. But here it is, and there it is in the Sfas-Emes as well. Proposition 17 says that God acts solely from the laws of his own nature, constrained by none. Now that sounds fine. That actually sounds kind of Jewish, doesn't it? God is completely free. God is constrained by no one. Right? Except, when you say constrained by none, that sounds Jewish. But acting solely from the laws of his own nature means what unfolds from God is unfolding of necessity and not because of some divine mind that's decided to do something. So this all-encompassing unity can become, continues depending on your poetic proclivities here. Either it's relentless or it's becoming even more inspiring in some way. And then we get to Proposition 29. And he says nothing in nature is contingent. Nothing. But all things are from the necessity of the divine nature, determined to exist and to act in a definite way. You won't find too many more deterministic sounding statements in any philosopher. But by this point, you are not so shocked by it because it's followed from all the things he has strung together in what I'm calling this kind of poetic ode that has gone on for this whole first part of the ethics. And a little bit later on, he says, just to put it succinctly, he says, it follows that God does not act from freedom of the will. Now, in an appendix of a couple of pages that adds on to the end of Part 1, here it is worth reading a little of his prose. And this is prose now. I should say, I keep talking about propositions. It's worth knowing, because if you read anything about Spinoza, they will talk about what they call the geometric method. That is, he writes this as if he's a latter-day Euclid, giving you theorems and corollaries and axioms and all of these things. That's how it's set up. That's why it's called this geometric method. And we don't usually think of Euclid as poetry, and there are probably a lot of people who don't think of Spinoza as poetry either. I actually do, and I'm trying to convey to you why. And now we get to an appendix, which really is prose. And he's going to say some important things here. What some of the things that has driven him to, or led him to this philosophical position. So he says, I've now explained the nature and properties of God. That God necessarily exists, that he's one alone, that he is and acts solely from the necessity of his own nature, etc., etc. And whenever the opportunity arose, I have striven to remove prejudices that might hinder the appreciation of my proofs. We have a lot of prejudices out there, and it makes it hard for people to accept what I'm writing here. So, since they're still out there, I thought it proper at this point to bring these prejudices before the bar of reason. Now, all the prejudices which I intend to mention here turn on this one point. The widespread belief among men that all things in nature are like themselves in acting with an end in view. We think we are always acting with some end in view. I have a goal, I have an objective, I'm going to create a plan and do that. And we have this widespread belief that somehow everything in nature is in some way doing that. In fact, in particular, they hold it as certain that God himself directs everything to a fixed end. For they say that God has made everything for man's sake and has made man so that he should worship God. So this is the first point I want to consider. Seeking the reason why most people are victims of this prejudice and why all are so naturally disposed to accept it. And then I'm going to demonstrate its falsity. And then I'm going to show how it has been the source of misconception about good and bad and right and wrong and praise and blame and all similar things. So we're going to skip to what he thinks the bad consequences of this have been. Consider what has been the upshot, he says. Among so many of nature's blessings, they were bound to discover quite a number of disasters, such as storms, earthquakes, diseases, and so forth. And they maintained that these occurred because the gods were angry at the wrongs done to them by men, or the faults committed in the course of their worship. And although daily experience cried out against this, you don't need a better example of crying out against this than the book of Job, Job crying out and saying, no, I didn't do anything wrong. So, although daily experience cried out against this, and showed by any number of examples that blessings and disasters befall the godly and the ungodly alike without discrimination, they still didn't, on that account, abandon their ingrained prejudice. It has this amazing staying power. For they found it easier to regard this fact as one among other mysteries that they could not understand. Here you're getting the scientific 17th century person there who's not going to accept this idea if it's a mystery. And thus they maintained their present and innate condition of ignorance, rather than to demolish in its entirety the theory they had constructed and devise a new one. So they made it axiomatic that the judgment of the gods, or we could say God, is beyond human understanding. This truth might have evaded mankind forever had not mathematics, which is concerned not with ends, but only with the essences and properties of figures, revealed to men a different standard of truth. The scientific person of the 17th century speaking. And then, just to cap this off, says, if the things produced directly by God were brought about to enable God to attain an end, then of necessity, the last things for the sake of which the earlier things were brought about would excel all others. And again, this doctrine negates God's perfection. For if God acts with an end in view, he must necessarily be seeking something that he lacks. And although theologians and metaphysicians may draw a distinction between a purpose arising from want and an assimilative purpose, they still admit that God has acted in all things for the sake of himself. For prior to creation, they're not able to point to anything but God as a purpose for God's action. Before creation, there's only God. What happened to trigger this idea of I have got to create? So he's now in this this addendum to part one, giving you a little bit, he's taking you back to the kinds of thought processes that made him realize the inadequacy of some of the things that people were saying, that we take for granted that God acts out of will and out of a sense of purpose. And it actually has, as we would put it, he doesn't quite say this, that has victims. That tells people who for whom disaster has befallen that there's something wrong with them. And that is something he is, it's not so much a moral issue if he can't abide it, he just thinks it's nonsensical. And there has to be a better understanding of what the nature of things is, and if we're going to talk about an ultimate force or a source of power, it's not going to be able to be that with which he was raised in his earliest years in Amsterdam. So yes, this is surely not the God of the Torah. This is surely not the God of the second paragraph of the Shema. If you do the following, things will go well and you'll have plenty of crops, and if you don't, the rain's going to be shut off. This is not the creator of heaven and earth. Instead, it's a substance of infinite attributes. How do you pray to that? This is a new kind of piety, if it's to be called piety at all. And it's a different kind of worship, if you're going to call it worship at all. It's of existence itself, of being itself. Spinoza, as one scholar put it, we think of him as denying the transcendent status of the divine, that God is a just transcendent being beyond us. But he says that what we sometimes miss is that the denial of the transcendent status of the divine is connected to this seeking to divinize the natural world, to find God in this most immanent way. That's I-M-M-A, and the opposite of transcendent, this indwelling God. You may know that one of Spinoza's great admirers was Albert Einstein. And here's something that Einstein said. It's part of a biographical thing that was written by Banish Hoffman. These are Einstein's words. The religious feeling engendered by experiencing the logical comprehensibility of profound interrelations is of a somewhat different sort from the feeling that one usually calls religious. It is more a feeling of awe at the scheme that is manifested in the material universe. It does not lead us to take the step of fashioning a godlike being in our own image, a personage who makes demands of us and who takes an interest in us as individuals. There is in this neither a will nor a goal, nor a must, but only sheer being. Einstein, it's no wonder that he was drawn to Spinoza's philosophy. The idea that we create, when we image God, we're always extrapolating from the things we believe about ourselves. We want to punish people when they do things that are contrary to our desires. That's what God does to us. And the fact that it's in Scripture, I know, carries a lot of weight for us. But remember, I started with Stephen Jay Gould telling you this isn't the Renaissance anymore. You don't get to say it must be right because it's an authoritative document from hoary antiquity. It's going to be right only if it passes the test of reason. And for him, it doesn't pass the test of reason. It didn't pass the test of reason for Einstein either. this was what was what Spinoza was doing was also in talking about, and the appendix gives you that sense that he's trying to liberate us from what he will call inadequate ideas. So, a concept that he got from Descartes, who was a little bit before him, and whom he read as well, to a place of clarity and understanding. So it's worth now going to a slightly different but related subject here that's also taken up in the ethics. And it's the last big thing I want to do tonight. And this is something that has been very, very wonderfully pointed out for us, I think, in the work of Yirmiyahu Yovel, Israeli interpreter of Spinoza. Knowledge from the time of the beginning of rabbinic Judaism, knowledge had a central role in defining religious devotion and virtue in rabbinic Judaism. It wasn't true in the Bible. Jeremiah said, "Let not the wise man glory in his wisdom. What you glory in is heeding God." I don't care how many degrees you have on your resume, that's not what, you know, what virtue is, and that's not what religious life is about. Maybe a nice thing. It's not what you glory in. You glory in heeding God. But in rabbinic Judaism, the knowledge of Torah becomes, and this is clearly under some Greek influence for knowledge being virtue, so knowledge has had this central role in rabbinic Judaism. But Yovel's suggestion is that it took on an even bigger and even broader meaning, particularly for these conversos and children and grandchildren of conversos, than it had even for rabbinic Judaism. It was not just virtue. It was the ultimate way to find meaning. Because if you couldn't openly practice the things that you wanted to practice, it was the knowledge of them, it was the thinking about them, it was that life of the mind that becomes proportionately that much more important. If the way to salvation was originally to mitzvot, and you can't do the mitzvot, the way to salvation is going to be the comprehension of and the dwelling on the mitzvot that you cannot do. So I'm going to turn to a couple of other things in the ethics, and these are, I will tell you frankly, things that befuddle a lot of commentators with especially good reason. But they're here, and they have their own kind of inspiring poetic to it. So in part two of the ethics, kind of a surprise, it's sort of pulled out of a hat a little bit, at some point Spinoza talks about the various ways in which we can attain knowledge. And there are two major ways that he talks about, and one is not very adequate, and the other is adequate. The things that are inadequate are, we see something and we form an opinion about it by virtue of what it appears to be to us. We're sometimes wrong about that. There are such things as illusions. There are such things as misapprehensions. We might hear something from hearsay. It might be that someone tells us that, you know, the ancient Greeks said this and therefore it must be right. This is kind of inadequate knowledge. The second way of attaining knowledge is by doing the kind of reasoned analysis that gets you to the heart of things and teaches you about the true nature of things. And this is the scientific person speaking, and that is reason and knowledge, what he calls knowledge of the second kind. And then without any warning, he says, apart from these two kinds of knowledge, there is a third kind of knowledge, which I shall refer to as intuition. Now, he wrote in Latin, which is a little hard to fathom, actually, when you think about it, doing all this in Latin, but that's what they did. So this was scientia intuitiva, this kind of intuitive knowledge. He will refer to it as intuition, and this kind of knowledge proceeds from an adequate idea of the formal essence of certain attributes of God to an adequate knowledge of the essence of things. That's kind of fancy language. But it's instead of doing the kinds of things that a scientist will do in the laboratory or in various kinds of experiments, don't think of a modern laboratory necessarily in the 17th century, but by experimentation, empirical discovery, that's one way of achieving things. But once you have achieved that knowledge, his claim is that there can be, and he actually talks about this, that sometimes in a flash, the connection between that and some other things that you know becomes so evident that you almost kind of wonder, why didn't I see that immediately? This is what he considers to be something like this third kind of knowledge, this intuition. Why is this so important? Because much later on, when we get to part five of the Ethics, when he gets back to this idea, because when he introduces this early on, he says, I'm going to get back to this later. Well, he finally does get back to it later. And now we're back a little into the poetry here. He says, from this third kind of knowledge, there arises the highest possible contentment of mind. This is what makes you feel at home in the world. When you're not bucking the things that are, you know, the bumps in the road. When you have, you know, someone once described this as the philosophy of a masochist, right? That is, you're taking, he caricatured it as taking joy in the laws of physics that bring that bullet closer to your head. You know? that's obviously a caricature. But Spinoza is onto something here in that there are always two elements to pain and to discontent. And one is the actual pain, whether it's physical or emotional pain, and the other is the experience of that pain and the sense of being isolated, of the world being against you. And this is a kind of he's engaging in a kind of therapy here about, you may not be able, that's what he said in that passage from part four that I read to you earlier. We will do our best to deal with the things that are contrary to our advantage, but we'll be in better shape if we can somehow accept the fact that we're part of the whole of nature whose order we follow. We won't add insult to injury by feeling that somehow the world is against us. It's bad enough that something has happened that we experience as being against our best advantage. But we only make it worse if we conclude from this that we are isolated outliers in the world, that is, and the world is somehow our enemy. He's insisting the world cannot be your enemy because the world is God and that's all there is. So from the third kind of knowledge, this kind of intuition of the unity of everything, there arises the highest possible contentment of mind. And a page or two later he says, we take pleasure in whatever we understand by this third kind of knowledge, and this is accompanied by the idea of God as cause, not cause as in God decides to do something, but the necessary unfolding of things. And then he says, the intellectual love of God, a very important phrase for Spinoza, the intellectual love of God, which arises from the third kind of knowledge, is eternal. So Yovel makes the argument that, like the Muranos, Spinoza was looking for an alternative road to salvation. And he was doing it in defiance of the one that was traditionally accepted in his established culture. For the Muranos, it was in defiance of the Christianity that they were forced to adopt. For Spinoza, it's in defiance of all of the conventional religion that he has concluded is based on inadequate knowledge. So Spinoza looked for it beyond all historical religions. It's by this third kind of knowledge that philosophers are eventually supposed to be able to attain what the great mystics and religious aspirants have always been seeking but inevitably failed to find. Salvation is the overcoming of finitude, of being able to understand yourself as part of an infinite enduring whole. It's a state achieved within this life rather than after it. And that's critically important. This isn't about salvation that's going to come to me in the next world because I'm suffering here. This salvation and even immortality, if you will, is a state that you have to believe can be achieved in this life. How is immortality possible? This is Yovel speaking now. To answer in a word, he says, it's not possible. Not in the usual sense of immortality. When the third kind of knowledge takes place, I know myself through my particular essence as it is part of God. But it gains this eternity within this life and not beyond it. And this is the basis of salvation in Spinoza on which all the rest hinges. It's an occurrence within this life and world. As eternity penetrates my actual existence and transforms its quality and direction, it's about overcoming finitude, not overcoming my mortality. With apologies to Woody Allen, who famously said, I don't want to achieve immortality through my work. I want to achieve immortality by not dying. This is the exact opposite of what Spinoza was trying to teach us. Really interesting. Maimonides had a son named Avraham. And Avraham ben Haramba, you see him referred to in the literature as Abraham Maimoni, he insisted that when his father said that, which Moses Maimonides did say this, when Moses Maimonides wrote that the world to come is not a world that follows this world, but exists right now. Even though most people in his own day thought what he meant was, you don't have to wait until everyone is dead and there's, you know, the whole world order is going to get into that. When you die, you can be entered into the world to come, even though the rest of the world is still going on. Abraham, his son, said, no, that's not what he meant. What he meant was, the world to come is here. It happens, this salvation happens in this life. And actually my teacher, Gerson Cohn, of blessed memory, was able to show that that was a common view among the rabbis of Andalusia in his day. And this was the means for alternative or secular salvation. This is a secular vision of what salvation is. And this is what he says at the very, nearly almost the last words of the Ethics. He says, the common belief of the multitude is that they think they're free to the extent that they can indulge their lusts, and that they're giving up their rights to the extent that they are required to live under the commandments of the divine law. And they believe that these are burdens that they hope to lay aside after death, when they will receive the reward of their servitude, that is, of piety and religion. And it's not by this hope alone, but also and especially by fear of incurring dreadful punishment after death, that they are induced to live according to the commandments of the divine law as far as their feebleness and impotent spirit allows. And if men did not have this hope and this fear, and if they believed that minds perished with bodies, and that they, miserable creatures worn out by the burden of piety, had no prospect of further existence, they would return to their own inclinations and decide to shape their lives according to their lusts, and to be ruled by fortune rather than by themselves. This is exactly what someone I met some years ago, a few of you know this story, but the whole story is not so important, who lives in the Bible Belt in Southern Virginia. And when we got to talking about my being Jewish and practicing Judaism, he said, do you really believe that you'll go to hell if you eat pork? And I realized in that moment how sad a question that was. People who believe that religion is going to hell. And that's exactly what Spinoza's talking about at the end of part 5. He says there are too many people who think that freedom is being able to do whatever I want. Freedom is understanding what the noble life is that can unfold from the nobility of the totality of nature. That's what freedom is. Freedom is following the line that human beings, like everything else in nature, are supposed to be determined to follow. And this is, he finds this to be just a vulgarism that he's unable to bear. And that's why this is called the ethics. Because this is about developing nobility and getting beyond your individual lusts and seeing yourself as part of something much larger. The very famous last line of the ethics is, all things excellent are as difficult as they are rare. This is not for everyone. This therapy about how to deal with adversity and suffering, I would never as a rabbi propose it to someone who's in the midst of suffering right now. But as something to ponder, as a poetic inspiration, as something that one might consider as a way of thinking of God in an alternative way, there's something there. It can be seen to have nobility, and it can be seen, in, I think, to have a deep spirituality to it. And as I said, it's not an accident, I don't think, that there are some affinities both with Hasidic and Neo-Hasidic thought. But that's going to be for 2 weeks from now. For tonight, I want to end with a beautiful memoir fragment from another Spinoza interpreter. This one is Louis Feuer, who was one of the most important interpreters of Spinoza's political philosophy in particular. So here's what Feuer wrote. I belong to that generation of young Jews in the 1920s. For whom Spinoza was a symbol of both revolt and reason. We were the children of the Talmud Torah on New York's East Side, and we knew the orthodoxy of its synagogues. But we were also part of the schoolboy crowd that sought a glimpse of Einstein when he came to America, telling of strange new ideas of space and time. We felt the constrictedness of the ghetto's intellectual bounds. Then we heard of this philosopher who had been excommunicated, but who had found a way for a man to be both a scientist and a believer in God. A teacher at high school told us that Spinoza had proved the existence of God mathematically. Well, we got hold of the ethics in a public library, and I found that I was a little disappointed in the proof. A society that came into existence, the Spinoza Institute of America, as he describes it as half crackpot, at one of its public lectures, I heard Morris Raphael Cohen discuss Spinoza's conception of nature with reverence. And he closed with Spinoza's dictum that I just read to you, that all things excellent are as difficult as they are rare. Spinoza's pantheism and determinism have long ago lost their attraction for me. Yet what remained for those of my generation was the sense of a man of unparalleled honesty, moved by a vision which, for all its exaggeration, grasped a segment of reality, and in so doing was inspired to utterances of such simple philosophical beauty that only one who had shared in God's thoughts could have written them. So, I think that's not a bad place to end tonight, give you a sense of the poetics of the ethics, and we'll talk in 2 weeks a little more about the theological political treatise and some of the more pointed critiques of Judaism and where that might take us today and how we might respond to some of those challenges. Read Rebecca Goldstein's book, Betraying Spinoza. She's a good White Plains girl, and some of you may know her father was years ago the chazan at the Hebrew Institute, and we were in graduate school together when we studied Spinoza with Margaret Wilson. It's a wonderful book that it's an unusual kind of intellectual biography, and it's an easy read also. So it's called Betraying Spinoza.
If you want to go the hard way, and I'm by no means even implying that I will, is there a translation that you would recommend?
The translation done by Samuel Shirley, but Seymour Feldman is the commentator, writes the introduction for it, and it's published by Hackett. The Ethics is published together with the Treatise on the Emendation of the Understanding, but it's the Ethics, and you look for Shirley, the translator, and Seymour Feldman is the commentator.
Yeah. Few questions.
You'll do the recognizing, okay?
Do you think there is a confluence between the latter two types of knowledge? I was thinking that the third type of knowledge is sort of the aha moment for the scientific discovery.
So let me say a couple of things. I want to underscore that this is one of the most puzzling and, in a way, controversial things in Spinoza. What I'm giving you is, again, in the spirit of kind of reading it kind of poetically, this is what seems to come off the page with it. But there's a whole literature on what this third kind of knowledge might mean. But one thing that Spinoza does seem to say pretty clearly is that it's not that it's getting you to a different kind of knowledge than the second kind of knowledge. It's that you're seeing it the same endpoint in a very different way. You're seeing it, as the modern Hebrew expression would say, begadol, in the largest scheme possible, and in a way that's, now the word intuition is a very tricky word. I get in trouble with it all the time. Heschel talked about the intuitions that that the prophets had. That they could know things, they could know more things than they could demonstrate. That gets us back to Mr. Girdle. That it's possible to know more things than you could demonstrate, and that it comes from this kind of intuition. But when you use the word intuition, people now conjure up these images of a relativism run amok, how can I trust your intuition or my intuition for that matter? We have to have, hard kinds of facts and reliable laws in order to keep a good harness on society. Well, they're right to some extent. Society without laws and without science and without truth, God help us, can be a society run amok. But a society that also does not have some of this reverence for the intuitive capacity of the human mind, the idea that we sometimes can grasp things that are not easily demonstrable, I think something is lost there as well. How you put all of this together is, in fact, another way of looking at the controversy of what in the world is Spinoza talking about here. Because I'm not sure exactly what he's talking about, but I know he's talking about something important.
I'm not exactly sure of the phrase expression, but some of the contributions to my not full understanding of everything you've been saying.
We're in the same boat. Yes, ma'am.
But if Spinoza was excommunicated, how has he continued, or has he continued, to influence different aspects of Judaism, like Hasidim? How did they get over the fact that he was excommunicated?
I'm not sure the Sfasem has ever read Spinoza. In fact, I'm quite sure he didn't. But he... people come to similar things for similar kinds of motivations, or similar things that make you wonder about things. It's not such
such a far-fetched thing to what I began with. You know, the Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. What does it mean for God to be one? You don't have to be a 17th century person in Amsterdam with a chip on his shoulder towards his Jewish teachers to ask that question. You can be a Hasidic Rebbe in the late 19th century and ask the same question. And you might even come to a similar kind of answer. Which and there have been throughout the history of Hasidism various kinds of approaching the line and sometimes even getting a little over the line of certain kinds of pantheisms. You know, one of the Hasidic mottos was in Aramaic, "Let atar panui mine." There is no place devoid of God, which is another way of saying God is in everything. You know, now that doesn't quite mean that everything is God, but you're already getting to something that's very different from what most of us, I think, were probably raised with, which is this Art Green calls it the vertical metaphor. You know, we're down here, and there's this transcendent God up there. And remember, what the word transcendent means quite literally is it's beyond the steps. Meaning, if it's beyond the steps, you can't get there. The steps get you to where the steps get you. If it's beyond the steps, you can't get there. That's very different from this indwelling, immanent God. Maybe we'll talk a little in 2 weeks about how, in an odd kind of way, the insistent transcendence of Maimonides, actually when it's taken to its limiting point, actually becomes immanence, because it just, this transcendent God kind of takes over everything.
This might be too global of a question, but where does Spinoza's thought leave room for building a house or sowing crops or doing anything but living in a state of nature?
Or writing a treatise about the importance of free thought and democracy,
which is exactly that.
You know, that's a theological political treatise, considered one of the greatest arguments for free speech and free thought in liberal society. So we will have to talk about that a little bit. It won't surprise you to know that this has been a head scratcher and a conundrum for Spinoza interpreters for a long time. But you do have to understand that freedom is sometimes, philosophers use language in ways that is very specific to them, and it doesn't necessarily match our usual way of thinking. Let me give you an example that you actually know. It's a little trivial, but you maybe get a sense of it. It's about freedom. When you say someone is in free fall, is that person free in the colloquial sense? That person's about to get crushed by the, by the ground. But that person is in free fall because there are no extraneous forces other than the forces that there are that are acting on this person. Mm-hmm. Gravity is one of the fundamental forces, and when you're in free fall, to not be in free fall is you suddenly pull out a parachute and something now has intruded onto this kind of natural moment. So we even sometimes use the word freedom ourselves in ways that kind of contradict what we usually think about freedom. And that's what he's saying in that last part of the, that last appendix in part 5. He says, so many people think that freedom is doing whatever you want. Freedom is the knowledge to understand what's right. That's when you are freely acting out the part of the human being. He's a deeply moral person. And that may be part of the political activism, even though in the usual sense of you're not free, then why are you doing this? What's going to happen is what's going to happen. But he clearly didn't believe that. Otherwise, he just would have sequestered himself somewhere else and not given a darn about what was happening around him. But he did. So we'll do the best we can on that in 2 weeks. Okay.
We could be here until tomorrow. We'll take a question from this side, a question from that side, and then we'll wait till 2 weeks from now.
Did Spinoza flirt with the idea that there was no God, that there was just nature?
Well, he keeps saying God or nature. You know, he's careful. If you want to take a very kind of you know, what's called the hermeneutic of suspicion. You always suspect everything that he says. And you can say that he really means nature, but he keeps saying God or nature so that he's not going to be accused of being an atheist. I don't believe that. I think he was sincere and actually quite serious about this. So, but it is a very different God. Look, there are not every religion in the history of humankind has had the same kind of image of God as a transcendent being dispensing bennies to good people and dispensing punishment to bad people. That's not the only conception of the divine in human history. So by saying this isn't the God that I was taught in my Jewish day school or at my mother's and grandmother's knee, is not to say that a person is not godly in some sense. You have to listen carefully and respectfully for what they are experiencing as the divine in the world and how they understand it. I kind of jokingly said to my own congregation not so long ago that I think what we need in this country is we have to abolish the political parties as they are and create two other political parties. One political party would consist of all the people that you're comfortable leaving your children with, and the other political party would be everyone else. Right? I would have no hesitation in leaving my kids with Spinoza.
So I had a question of what is Spinoza's standing right now, I mean in modern times, amongst philosophers and Jewish thinkers?
His status?
Yeah,
there was some, I don't remember exactly when it was, there was some little ceremony at Mount Scopus at some point that lifted the ban. It had no real meaning any more than the ban in 1656 had any meaning. His status is... no one bothered me teaching this at Jewish Theological Seminary with rabbinical students. He's taught. I mean, I don't think you'll find the ethics in the bookshelf of the base medrash in New Square, for example. But I'm sure Spinoza's works are there at Yeshiva University, and it probably is taught there in one way or another, even if it's largely a critique. But when you critique something, you're already taking it seriously and showing it. The bigger issue is that also probably will never be resolved: is Spinoza a Jewish philosopher? He's a philosopher and he's Jewish, at least by birth. Is he a Jewish philosopher? What does it mean to be a Jewish philosopher? Does it mean that you're trying to further Jewish thought? You're probably not. Does it mean that you're a philosopher that's drawing on a lot of Jewish stuff and dealing with Jewish questions and still posing challenges to people who are more connected to Judaism than he ever wanted to be? I would say he is. But no one has a completely agreed upon definition. So that's a kind of a status issue. Which column does he appear in? And, is there such a thing as Jewish philosophy? That's a whole other question. Right? There's such a thing as Jewish theology. There's no such thing as Jewish physics. Is there such a thing as, there are physicists who are Jews. There's no such thing as Jewish physics. Is there such a thing as Jewish philosophy? Some people would deny that philosophy by its nature is, if we had Richard Dawkins here, he would say, of course there's no such thing as Jewish philosophy. Jewish is anything, Jewish, Christian, those things have certain kinds of dogmas. They have certain kinds of starting points that are not scientific, and the philosophical mind has to be neutral, has to be... So that's a whole other definitional question. I know I sound like I'm just, dancing around your question, but I think the question, kind of generates all kinds of dances, right? what is his status in what way? If the status is most basically Is this someone who is still to this day, even by people who are practicing Jews and practicing Christians and practicing Muslims, to the extent they know of him, is this someone that they think is worth reading and worth confronting and worth dealing with? I would say yeah.
And I'm struck by how talking about such big ideas is also so intimate. I mean, I think it brings us to a place of where transcendent and imminent meet in us. It's a very, very intimate conversation, and one that maybe you're having with yourself, but the things that we hold very close. And I'm very grateful that we'll have a second time to continue this. Spinoza Bagel.